current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. According to the Deadline Detroit website today, Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson is profiled in the new edition of The New Yorker. Deadline Detroit says that reporter Paige Williams writes of Patterson's decades of hostility toward the city, of his alleged love of sprawl, and his unique ability to make a joke out of just about anything, including things that arguably shouldn't be joked about, but also of the success that he has enjoyed in Oakland County, quote, clean, progressive government, high bond ratings, and the like. Brooks Patterson in this week's New Yorker magazine. Today on Martin Luther King Day here on Current State, learn about an early effort to identify places in East Lansing that have significance regarding human rights. A local chapter of Sites of Conscience is taking root in East Lansing. We'll meet with an organizer. Also, East Lansing's Broad Art Museum is profiled tonight on WKAR-TV. We'll tell you about that later this hour. But first, the North American International Auto Show is underway at Cobo Center in Detroit. Hundreds of thousands of people will visit the show to see the latest cars, trucks, and prototypes. And our Scott Pohl and Peter Worf both visited the show last week when the media had access, and they're both here to preview a week's worth of auto show coverage here on Current State. Good to see you both.
Good morning.
Peter, the auto show is always special. How did it strike you this year?
You know, as always, I've had the chance to attend several auto shows now, but as always, as soon as I walk in, I'm struck by the enormity of the entire situation.
Yes.
It's incredible. The staging, the video screens, it's like walking onto a futuristic movie set. For me, that movie might be the early 2000s Minority Report, you know, which sort of starred video technology and concept cars. I think there was even some car product placement in the vehicle that Tom Cruise drove. It was a Lexus, if I wasn't mistaken.
I think you're right.
You know, right? But, you know, concept cars, of course, are one of the things that is the star of the auto show, attracting the most cameras much of the time. Some of the things that made an impression on me were the new Honda fuel cell electric vehicle. It was sort of one of the most futuristic cars that at the same time looked sort of realistic. Like it might be something that could look like what you'd see come off the line.
Okay.
Pretty interesting. The Audi new all-road features a front and rear electric motor, which creates that all-wheel drive with a motor in the front and a motor in the back. Also something new was even Kia getting into the act with its Stinger sports car. And Scott, you and I were talking about the Toyota PV, the personal vehicle.
Very cool little car.
Kind of a
cool
looking,
I should say.
Exactly.
Can't
kind
get
of
it
a,
yet.
Sort of a one-seater, if you can imagine, you know, maybe a most futuristic recumbent bike. Yeah. Really, really strange, but that's how concept cars go. Another word that popped into my mind with a lot of the new cars was efficiency. Efficient vehicles from BMW, Volkswagen, the new Chrysler 200, and then one of the most talked about, the all-new Ford F-150 for 2015. With
aluminum body.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right, the all-aluminum body, brand new and somewhat controversial, too, with those materials and costs, and we'll see what happens with Ford. And speaking of pickups, the Ford F-150 and the Silverado, the truck of the year, those weren't the only two trucks that we looked at this week. We'll have a look at the all-new Chevy Colorado. We'll be talking about that later in the week. And another thing I'm going to be bringing you are sort of the non-car activities and interaction, some fun for kids and families and things that you can actually do at the auto show.
Great. Look forward to it an awful lot.
Lots of fun.
Scott, what about you?
Well, the big news out of the auto show last week was the announcement of the North American Car and Truck of the Year Awards. It was a clean sweep for the Chevrolet division of General Motors. The Car of the Year is the Corvette Stingray, and the Truck of the Year Award went to the Silverado. I talked with Chevy's Director of Marketing, Russ Clark, about what it means to GM to win both awards in the same year.
It was a great day, but it does represent a lot of years of hard work and dedication to come out with the best trucks and cars in the market in the world, which is our goal. So to win North American Car of the Year, North American Truck of the Year, clean sweep for Chevrolet, really is a great testament to what we've been doing, and we're very, very proud and humbled by the awards.
Well, you had another finalist this year. You had the winner of Car of the Year last year, so a couple of good years for General Motors.
Oh, absolutely. And, again, it's our goal to continue to build the best. We challenge ourselves every day, and a lot of things that we need to try and achieve, and we're working hard to achieve them all.
Assuming you've been with General Motors through bankruptcy and everything, did you ever see this day coming back in the darkest days of General Motors?
Well, we had always been working on improving our processes, improving our product development. So a lot of things you see today, we have been in process and work and development for many, many years. So the ability now to really focus on a few key brands has really helped. And then also the ability to really, go at it with a clean balance sheet and work those elements has allowed us to focus on the core business. So I think, as you said, I've been here a long time, and I've seen a lot. I always knew we've a great company, a great bunch of people working on it, all dedicated to do the best we can.
How does Chevrolet capitalize on these Car of the Year and Truck of the Year awards?
Well, certainly, in the marketplace, very tough, very competitive, and awards help you stand out. Certainly in the trucks, it's an extremely competitive marketplace. To have Truck of the Year recognized for the advancements made by the new Silverado is really key for us. We'll continue to mention the advancements and the benefits that the Silverado provides and be competitive in the marketplace, and the awards actually add aura and everything to the car. Corvette, of course, is a performance car. It was the most awarded car in 2013, so we look at the North American Car of the Year Award, very prestigious award, as a culmination of, again, a lot of hard work, and we'll build on that. Like yesterday, we announced the new Z06 and the C7R race car, so those will help lead us in terms of working through the marketing next year, racing being an incredibly important part of the Corvette experience.
2014 shaping up to be a solid year for Chevrolet then?
Well, sure. We've got coming off a great year globally. We sold almost 5 million cars, set another record for Chevrolet globally. In the U.S., we did extremely well too, continued to build our business. Silverado sales were up. We want to continue on that next year. This year, we've got some important launches with the all-new Colorado coming out. Of course, Corvette Z06. So, focus on continuing to improve our products, improve our marketing, improve our presence in our business parameters going forward.
Talk about cutting into the market share that the Ford F-150 has. Can Chevrolet get a bigger chunk of that market?
Well, like I said, last year we did increase our sales and our market share for Silverado, and that's, of course, always our goal. It's a tough competitive marketplace. We have two very strong competitors and a couple other folks that would like to become bigger in the truck market, so it just keeps getting more competitive every day, so we have to be our best. Continue to improve our product, continue to make sure the consumers know the benefits of our products and come to Chevrolet. And there's one other advantage we have at Chevrolet. We have done this unprecedented revamp of our entire dealer network. So we have new facilities, new approaches, new customer focus in the dealerships. It's an excellent place to shop and a great focus on customer satisfaction.
Yeah. Russ Clark of Chevrolet, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Powell.
And tomorrow, here on Current State, Peter Worf has a look ahead again at the much-anticipated Chevy Colorado on display at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit through Sunday. Also coming today to WKAR.org, look for our slideshow of images from the Detroit Auto Show. Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. As we just heard, Michigan's surging auto industry is front and center this week in Detroit. But young Americans may be a shrinking part of the hoopla. Statistics from Edmunds.com, an online car shopping site, show Americans aged 18 to 34 account for just over 10% of new car sales. It's a segment the auto industry is concerned may be shifting to a lifestyle less reliant on cars. A host of factors appear to be involved. Bridge Magazine reporter Rick Hagland writes about the phenomena in the latest edition, and we welcome Rick to Current State. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Mark. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. You cite several factors in this trend toward being car-free, in particular for young people. What are a few of the key ones?
Well, some of them are economic. The millennial generation, people aged 18 to 31, are having a difficult time getting into the workforce. They're actually living with their parents at record rates. There was a statistic that came out from the Pew Research Center that found out that in 2012, 36% of people in that age group were still living with their parents. Of course, some of them were, you know, still in school, that sort of thing. But they're economically coming out of the gate a little slower than their parents' generation did. There's also some lifestyle changes, people moving into cities where they don't need a car and actually see a car as being sort of a hassle. Lifestyle changes. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, boys and young men in particular were really into cars, customizing them, and couldn't wait to get their first car, first driver's license. And that's changed. People seem to be a little more interested in other things, video games and electronic devices and what have you. So you add that all up, and there's some changes going on.
Sounds like the romance with cars might be at risk here, at least for younger people. Then
it seems like it. It's hard to say. I mean, anecdotally. I have kids, and I know a lot of young adults, and I don't see too many of them that are, you know, really into cars these days the way that I think you and I probably were.
Yeah. How are the car companies responding to this trend?
Well, they're sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude about it to some degree. I don't think they buy into it as much as some of the people who've done some research into this have. Their general view is that kids will eventually get jobs. They'll get back into the workforce. They'll start forming families, and once that starts happening, they're going to buy cars just like every previous generation has.
But you also write that everyone, not just young people, is driving less. Is it known what accounts for that?
Well, that's true. It's across the board, regardless of age. Some of it has to do with lifestyle changes, the urbanization of America. There's more telecommuting, aging population in which, once the kids are gone, you don't need as many vehicles in your household, and the kids who left may not be buying them. Mickey Maynard, who I quote in the Bridge story, uses a term that she calls driving light, where people are not necessarily totally giving up their cars, but they're not driving them as much as they used to. And they're using the car as part of a bigger transportation portfolio in which they may be using their bicycles, walking, using car sharing services such as Zipcar and that sort of thing.
Very interesting. I'd imagine the car companies are eager for younger people's salaries and job prospects to improve. Do they think that'll happen?
Well, they really do. I mean, they see this as sort of a temporary lull. We've gone through this huge recession in which the percentage of young people buying new cars went way down. It started to come up a little bit in 2012. They recovered quite a bit of the losses, but then last year went down again. So it's a little unclear where the trend exactly is going, but obviously the car companies need younger people to buy cars again, because the older people in the market have only got so many more cars to buy in their lifetime.
We're talking with Bridge Magazine reporter Rick Haglund about young Americans' changing views toward automobiles. It seems a family still needs a car in many, many cases, and young people are delaying getting married and starting families. How big a part of this is that?
Well, the car companies say that's a big part of it. That they firmly believe that once these young people finally do get into the market, they're going to create households. They're going to have children. They're going to move to the suburbs, just like everybody else did in generations before. And they're going to need cars. And there's a lot of truth to that. It's pretty tough to get your kid to soccer practice on the train or the bus.
Overall, it's very interesting, though, because there's all kinds of mixed signals here emerging from this. Overall, car sales in the United States are up.
Well, that's true. And one of the reasons for that is that new car sales actually make up a fairly small percentage of overall sales of vehicles. Far more people buy used cars than new cars. But they also represent kind of a smaller segment of the consumer spending dollar. Car companies have really moved upscale to some degree. Last year they sold, I think, 15.6 million cars and trucks, but there's over 100 million households in the United States. So a relatively small share of households actually bought new cars. And a lot of it is replacement vehicles. The average age of the vehicle is at record levels. It's about 11 years. So a lot of the people who bought cars actually bought them to replace older vehicles, whether they really wanted to buy a new car or not.
I'm wondering if the manufacturer's focus on technology in cars is in part driven by a desire to lure more young people. Is that conceivable to you?
Yes, it is, and they do talk about that. I mean, to some degree, the car has kind of become an iPad on wheels. It's got all sorts of technology inside of it. Things that you can do in front of your computer at home, you can do in your car.
Yeah.
Whether that's a good thing at all times or not is another question. But yes, technology is one area where they're really looking at to draw in younger buyers.
I have to ask if you've made it to the auto show yet.
I haven't yet. I'm a veteran of about 20 years of coverage of auto shows. I didn't go this year, but hoping to make it this week as a civilian.
I'll probably see you there. That's my plan as well. We want to thank Rick Haglund of Bridge Magazine for joining us here today on Current State. Rick, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
This year marks the anniversary of two crucial moments in our country's long history of inequality. 60 years ago, the Supreme Court handed out its landmark decision in Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education, which effectively ended legal segregation of our nation's public schools. And 50 years ago, this year, the Civil Rights Act was signed into law. Today, on the observance of Martin Luther King Day, the Michigan State University kicks off a year-long commemoration of these events with its Project 6050. And here to tell us more about Project 6050 is John Beck. John's an associate professor in the School of Human Resource and Labor Relations at MSU. Welcome back to Current State.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the genesis of Project 6050.
Well, a number of us have been talking now for well over a year. The idea came up that major anniversaries are a time to be able to look back and also to look forward. And it's interesting that you have so many anniversaries that are all focusing on this year, 2014. And the fact that it took 10 years between the Brown decision that really overturned the whole notion that separate but equal was okay in American schools and generally in American society. And then finally, 10 years later, the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act really tried to codify that notion in a variety of different ways that were significant. So various folks have been talking. We have a core planning team that's been trying to put together an umbrella for campus and for the community to be able to park a variety of different events, a variety of different conversations, different ways to really explore, to celebrate, to commemorate, and to build on this key set of civil rights, human rights advances with Brown on the one side and the 64 Act on the other.
Mm-hmm. How did Americans react to Brown versus Board of Education, the decision?
Well, I'm looking back, the thing I find so interesting about it is that, at least what I learned in school long ago, was that the Brown versus School Board was important because the fact that different kinds of evidence were allowed into the Supreme Court case that normally were not allowed. That is that Plessy versus Ferguson from the 1890s forward had really set up this whole notion that as long as you had equal facilities, you could have separate facilities, and therefore that was legally okay. I think that the Supreme Court had to listen to different kinds of sociological evidence, different kinds of evidence of what the real effect of separate but equal that went beyond simple kind of legal doctrines that looked in their mind, from the 1890s forward, as fairly sound. And so they had to be overturned based on what was the reality on the ground, not necessarily what did the framers of the act of the Constitution really mean by their interpretation of what constituted proper law.
Less theoretical and more on-the-ground reality.
Right. I think and they had to really look at what's the effect of this piece of law. What's the effect for people across the nation? But let me fast forward, I think, to 1964, because one thing about 6050 that everyone, I think, really has to hear loud and clear is that if you only focus on Brown, it could be regarded to be simply a conversation about race on campus and the community for this entire year. But the 64 Act looked at other human rights, other civil rights. So it was really about equality based on gender. It was equality based on age, equality based on religion, national origin. So I think that one reason that we really wanted to move forward with 6050 was to be able to say, how far have we come, but how far do we still need to go? Mm. Naturally, on issues of, let's take gender for instance, you know, Equal Pay Act is kind of stalled in legislative action for years. There are still a huge gap between what men make and what women make within the workplace. Based on national origin, naturally, issues of immigration, issues of ongoing prejudice based on where one might be from continue to be at issue. Then there's all the kind of rights yet not codified. Naturally, the kind of equality of marriage kinds of acts and other things, so that we really want to use this year as a conversation about civil rights and human rights writ large. So much of the conversation, I think, in the community on campus will not only be on the history of these two events, but we'll be on linked issues. Right now we have an exhibit at the MSU Museum on South Africa. There will be, I'm sure, a number of discussions across campus on issues of human trafficking, on issues of labor rights in the U.S. and in other nations. So that I really believe that this is a great opportunity for people to try to come to grips with both a historical perspective and, you know, really standing on the shoulder of giants like Martin Luther King Jr. In terms of today, but the notion that you have to carry the work on, and the fact that we have an entire year, we're very excited because we're using these two weekends, this weekend and the Martin Luther King weekend in 2015, as bookends for the entire year of events. Classes, films, concerts, everything else is going to go under that rubric. So that means that there's a lot of ample opportunity for discussion, for commemoration, for celebration and exploration.
We're talking with MSU Professor John Beck about Project 6050. How have our conversations around civil rights changed in the last half century?
I think that one thing maybe that's happened dramatically is a shift between thinking about things collectively to thinking about things individually. So that during the civil rights movement, during the labor movement, other movements, it really was about trying to have large groups of people rise together. I think that we've probably seen a good amount of rights discussion come down to the rights of this individual rather than an overall group of people. And I think that that's one thing that I think I would characterize in terms of how rights discussions have changed. The other thing is I think that we have tried to understand, I think a lot of people on campus and across the community, that there are other kinds of rights. So the issue becomes one of does someone have the right to starve? Does someone have the right to be homeless? Does someone have the right to suffer economic inequalities of other sorts? So that there's this whole issue of what constitutes kind of right action and what are the kinds of things that we really need to do beyond simple kind of talks of equality to see what kind of effect it has, again, a la Brown versus School Board, on the ground today. What does it mean to be equal in America? What does it mean to be free in America? What does it mean to advance human and civil rights in America when there's still kind of a large to-do list that we have to take on?
I'm curious how you see your students engaging in discussions about human rights and race differently than, say, even 10 years ago. Do you notice changes like that?
I think the thing that amazes me about today's students is how connected they are. That is, we had to go to meetings to talk about things back in the 70s at MSU. Today, people simply have to, you know,
get online
or be on a Facebook page or be part of the conversation truly on their cell phones.
I'm wondering if something has gotten lost there, though. Could you argue that? I mean, are there people who argue that?
I'm not a communication expert.
It's a sociological kind of question,
well,
I guess, really.
I think it is. And I think that what is true of today's students is I think there's a great generosity. I think that there is a rising belief in social action. I believe that the newest students are very, very plugged into really making a difference. And I'm amazed, I don't know about you, Mark, but I'm amazed when I hear about a lot of the young entrepreneurs who have put together a phone app in support of stopping you know, some social wrong.
That is so noticeable. I think, to tell you the truth, just in the last 5 years or less, I think there's been a dramatic change in approach there.
And in that way, I think that they feel perhaps more powerful as individuals than, you know, we were the generation of marchers, and the generation before us were the generation of marchers. So the degree to which we believe perhaps now that that there are different ways to change the world, and that they're finding those new ways, I think that that's very, very exciting. And one emphasis, by the way, I have to mention about 60/50 is there one part of 60/50 is really an emphasis on service, so that Service Learning Center and others have put together a whole notion of give me 110, so 60 plus 50 equals 110, so 110 hours over the entire year of service. So in that way, it's there will be a huge aspect, I think, of 60/50 that really is about student involvement and about actually kind of carrying on the work. One thing that occurs to me, Mark, is that, you know, we always run the danger when we talk about history that somehow civil rights was something that happened back then, mm-hmm. or in my case, labor rights was something that happened back then. Well, each day people recreate progress, recreate really the struggle for more voice, for greater equality. And we hope that 60/50 carries on, that it's not simply a one-year commemoration, mm-hmm. that in reality it changes for campus and for the community in the lives of the students, staff, and faculty and others. It changes the way that they look at the coming years as well as this year.
John Beck is an associate professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations here at Michigan State University. John, thanks for telling us more about Project 60/50. I'm sure we'll be checking in throughout the year.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
State on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. Today, human rights are under attack in many parts of the world, but there is a pathway to building a just, humane, and peaceful future, the power of the past. That's how the organization Sites of Conscience explains its mission on its website, sitesofconscience.org. Sites of Conscience highlights historic moments and places associated with both the triumphs and transgressions of human rights. The organization, which has chapters around the world, hopes that focus will spark action and awareness today. Now, supporters in East Lansing are embarking on a mission to identify local sites associated with human rights, and the MSU Museum's Marcia McDowell is a part of that effort and joins us to tell us more. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks,
Marcia.
Mike.
I'm struck by the motto of Sites of Conscience, memory to action. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, I think the fact that so many incidents and places and people over time evoke memories, and people recall those incidents, recall those people, and are emotionally connected, angry about things. But the thing that the Sites of Conscience organization is looking for is to take those memories and translate those into action for social change.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're in the early stages of an effort to catalog and identify local sites of conscience. What would you like to see happen here?
Well, first of all, we realize that there's an absence of any collected information in the Lansing area about individuals who were significant in making a change, especially in human rights and civil rights, or any places there's no place that's mapped out where things happen.
Right.
And when we realized there was an absence, we said we should do something about that. Mm-hmm. And we started doing some research, and we realized that it's going to take a lot of work to find where these places are, because so much of it is embedded in memory and oral history, and not so much of it is documented in the historical record.
But you're saying there's some historical detective work that may be necessary.
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. Michigan State University Museum is a museum that is, I think, prides itself on being a museum without walls. We work within the community, and then we have things inside the walls of the museum. And this is one of those community outreach activities where we are hoping that we're going to engage campus folk, community folk in doing that heavy lifting, the research to find out where did things happen that made a difference in all of our lives.
I know you have started to look at a few sites, the MSU Student Services Building, for example, the site of the first, the Gay Pride office back in 71 or 2 or thereabouts.
Yeah, I mean, people take it for granted now that Gay Pride Week exists.
Right.
You know, it has always existed.
Right.
Well, it didn't. And there was a place and a moment in time when it was initiated at Michigan State University. So we want to mark that and celebrate that. And then going back to the memories, gather people's memories about that time and that era where that change was made.
Mm-hmm. And catalog that and commemorate it somehow. How might you commemorate these sites? Well, signs, plaques,
yeah,
that kind
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Wouldn't it be lovely to be able to put a mark, a historical marker, or be able to have an app on your phone with, you know, where you could get QR codes to create an itinerary for, maybe it is gay and lesbian rights in our community, or mm-hmm. maybe it's African-American rights, or maybe it's age-related rights in our community. Anything that could help you know that history took place right here, and you are actually standing at a spot, you could see the spot where something significant happened.
Mm-hmm. You have an interesting personal anecdote with regard to the home that you used to live in. Tell us about the house of the Brown House in East Lansing.
Exactly. Well, it's actually at the corner of Elm Street and Harrison Road in East Lansing, so it's just up the road from where we're sitting right now. And my husband, Kurt Dewhurst, and I moved into this building as grad students, and the person who owned the building was Dr. Robert Brown, who was with the history department at MSU. And he once told us the story that he, because he owned that building, rented what he believed was the first time he, renting to an African-American. It was either a young faculty member or a doctoral student, a place of residence in East Lansing. In other words, breaking the color barrier mm-hmm. for the East Lansing community. And we've never dug deeper to corroborate that story. We're keen to hear other people's memories of that period of time. Dr. Brown told us that story probably in circa 1975 or 1976, and he's mm-hmm. long gone. But it's interesting that if, in fact, it is true, that it means that there's a significant spot that people walk by every day or drive by
right.
every day where change happened.
Right. And this is where the historical detective work comes back in as well, because we really need to corroborate whether or not what Professor Brown said is accurate or not.
Exactly.
There was some other place that mm-hmm. actually predated that.
Exactly.
Now, the MSU Museum's connection with Sites of Conscience is tied to your exhibit that starts today on Ruby Bridges. Who was Ruby Bridges, and why are you telling her story?
Exactly. Well, the Ruby Bridges was the six-year-old elementary school student who in New Orleans on November 14th, 1960, went in to a, she she went into what had previously been a segregated school, and and she was the first black student to go into this school, elementary school, the William France School in Ninth Ward, by the way, Louisiana, New Orleans.
Oh, that was hit so hard by Katrina,
And parents of the other students of the school were so angry, there was a mob of angry students angry parents protesting her admission into the school. So she was accompanied by federal marshals. And that was a moment in time captured by the artist Norman Rockwell. It was also featured news daily on the evening news across the country. And it took almost a year before that protest died down and she was actually able to go freely in and out of the school without the mob.
And that exhibit begins today at the MSU Museum, we will point out here. We probably have listeners who may well be willing to help you with some of your historical detective work that you're embarking on with Sites of Conscience. Yeah. How can people connect with
you? Well, come to the museum first. There, we have a table where people can write information, fill out information sheets about places that they know or incidents that they know. And then we're going to have to either engage them in doing some self-research or we're going to try and find students who will help us do that. And ultimately have a great online resource that all of us will be able to turn to.
And in the meantime, I would recommend anyone interested in this very intriguing project visit the website of the main Sites of Conscience organization. That is simply sitesofconscience.org. The MSU Museum's Marsha McDowell, part of an effort to identify local sites associated with human rights. Marsha, thank you and good luck.
Thanks.
Current State on WKAR, thanks for joining us. Just over a year has passed since Michigan State University opened the Broad Art Museum. Through its design phase, construction, and opening, the angular structure has been embraced by some and detested by others while bringing worldwide attention to MSU. Now this evening, WKAR-TV debuts a 30-minute documentary film about the Broad Museum project, Wills and Steel. Airs tonight at 11:30 p.m. on WKAR-TV with a repeat at 11:30 p.m. on the 31st. And Current State Scott Pohl is here with a preview. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Tell us about the film we'll see tonight, then.
Well, as you said, it's called Wills and Steel. I talked with Linda Stanford about the making of the movie. She was the project coordinator from the selection of the design entered by award-winning architect Zaha Hadid through its opening. And she was the point person for getting this documentary made. Stanford helped select New York filmmaker Ulton Guilfoyle.
We talked about it early on during the development of the art museum when those of us charged with working on the project began to realize that this really was an exceptional moment for Michigan State, not because of our involvement as people behind the scenes to make it happen, but because it was a conflation of an interesting moment of a president who had a vision, a major donor who was an alumnus, and his artfully knowledgeable wife, and a world-class architect. And here we have these major players in the art world in terms of a major architect, a president who saw this as a wonderful opportunity for the university, and an alumnus who is an art collector, who wanted to do something special for Michigan State. So we had these major players and thought, this really needs to be something that is talked about because it really was the three of them working together, although geographically remote, to make this very unusual thing happen for Michigan State. Not unusual in the sense that Michigan State is world-class in terms of its scientific research, but that it was an unusual moment for Michigan State to really position itself in terms of arts and cultural programming in a cohesive way that without that major competition to find a special architect and without that hugely generous gift would not have been able to happen in such a momentous moment.
So a filmmaker was chosen to work on the project, but I know that people from WKAR were involved. Can you talk about the integration of staff from WKAR with a professional filmmaker in a project of this sort?
Yeah, this is another wonderful example where we had a person whom we hired who was based in New York, who would come here periodically, but in order to make it happen, as he clearly indicated from the beginning, there have to be other people working on this. So I called WKAR, spoke with Gary Reed and also with Tim Zico and other staff, and we figured out how to make this happen. There was another woman from the Department of Art History and Design, Jackie Sullivan, who was hired to be Olton Guilfoyle's on-the-ground contact person. And then different people from WKAR and also from the university community were asked to be involved in terms of providing their skills so that we could produce this film. So it was another example where Michigan State was working with an external professional, drawing on its own internal professionals to make this happen.
I would assume that along the way, you would occasionally see footage or be consulted about the content of the film. Would I be right about that?
We saw some footage, but actually it was, and so did Michael Rush, the director of The Broad, but we saw less footage than you might have expected. It wasn't a regular moment, and part of it was that it was a slightly different intent and then became more interested in being an artful film rather than a documentary in the sense of being a transcript. So we wanted it to have a vision or a director's voice that was evident in the creation of the film. And so we changed along the way. He was given more free rein than if we were to say we wanted to show what happened week by week or month by month in a very prescribed way. We really gave him the freedom to shape it.
That leads me to a question about the content of the film with regard to its promotional value as opposed to maybe being a warts and all sort of a document of this project, because there were some warts along the way, some delays, for instance. How would you position this final product in those regards? Is it a warts and all sort of a film that viewers will see?
We do talk about some of the time delays. Dan Bowman, particularly, who was a design administrator, speaks to that when he explains how the building was designed and then ultimately constructed. We talked a lot about the concrete. We chose to accept the reality that in any major architectural project, there are moments of time stress. And we had a clear vision in terms of what we wanted. This was a film of working very closely with the actual architects from Zaha Hadid and then with the architects from IDS, Integrated Design Solutions, and then with Barton Mallow. We used to have regular meetings to resolve all kinds of questions. I became knowledgeable of things that I never thought I would even know about. In terms of buildings, I actually probably can give a talk about art heat trace, which is something you think about when you're concerned with how a building made of glass deals with condensation and so forth. But that was the intent. It wasn't supposed to be an expose, but if, as you go from the title, it was meant to be a film that really focused more on the vision, the intent, because we didn't know when we started who the architect was going to be. We didn't know where the building was going to be built. We didn't know how long it actually would take. We also didn't know about the community response to the structure, but we could feel that as we moved along, that people were overwhelmingly positive. There always are some people who say this looks out of line from what the rest of the university has built. But that was ultimately the intention, and that's the kind of message that we wanted to make clear. I think also in terms of audience that it can show that at an unexpected moment in time, when you have a president, a leader who is thinking years out, and you have an architect who dreams, and you have a donor who also dreams, that the three can come together beautifully. And that's where the title comes from. It really is about the wills of these three people, and then the steel obviously speaks to the external facade of the building.
A final question then would be your satisfaction level with the finished product. How happy are you with this document of the construction of the Broad Art Museum?
When the building opened and Zaha Hadid had a chance to walk through it with her team before the public went through, she was exceedingly pleased. And if you've ever seen pictures of her, she's hesitant to smile. She actually is a very gracious person, but she was reserved in terms of her public persona. She was very pleased. And among the things that she indicated was that it was much better built in terms of the construction details than some of her other buildings. Her team was very pleased about that. And that was another exciting thing about watching this project unfold, was seeing the workers, the many, many different kinds of talents and skills that were brought to making this building real. And I was fortunate to have an opportunity occasionally to talk to a worker who was on the building site. And every single one of them said it was an exciting project to work on, because they had to draw on all of their own creative talents in order to make it happen. And I think that's what people feel when they come to this building. They see it from the outside, they're curious. You go inside, it's actually quite different inside than you might expect from the outside. And the building is challenging, and that's exactly what we wanted. And that's what you want on a university campus, is architecture that will inspire you to think, to be a little unsettled, and then to draw on all of your senses to understand it. And that's what learning's about. That's what a university should have in the shape of its art museum, not only in the building, but then also in terms of the programming that takes place within it.
Linda Stanford, thank you so much for joining us on Current State.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
This is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, more from the Detroit Auto Show, including a discussion about electric cars. Also, an MSU early education specialist weighs in on changing approaches to early childhood education. That and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us for Current State on 90.5 WKAR. You got the difficulty, baby.